Thank you very much, and welcome to all of you. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a technical writer on the Exchange team. Among other things, I write the product documentation on TechNet in areas such as high availability and site resilience and storage and a few other areas as well. And I'm very excited to be here talking about high availability in Exchange Server 2013. CU2 is our latest build, so that's what we'll focus on. Now, Exchange 2013 has been around for a while, so it's likely that most of you already know about the many new features that we have around the areas of storage, high availability, and site resilience. For example, we introduced a feature called multiple databases per volume, which is a configuration option that lets you store multiple databases on the same single disk. We also introduced a feature called auto reseed, which is a mechanism whereby the system can automatically grab a spare disk that has been pre-provisioned by an administrator and use that disk to replace a disk that has failed in your environment. Another fantastic feature. We also introduced self-recovery behaviors, specifically the ability for Exchange to recover from failures that would normally require an administrator. For example, some sort of storage problem that would typically require in the past an administrator to push the power button to correct it. Those kinds of incidents can be automatically corrected by Exchange 2013 today as well. We've also done a lot of work in the area of high availability. We've introduced new technology called managed availability, which extends high availability to all other areas outside of the database availability group. So that includes client access components, Outlook web app, Exchange Active Sync, Outlook, basically every other component that makes up Exchange. We've also done some work in the area of site resilience, where we have given you new configuration options that previously weren't possible before. Now, I'm not going to talk about those things in detail because we've already been talking about those things for more than a year now. And if you're interested in learning about those features, I would go to one of those URLs where you can see one of my tech ed presentations where I went through each of these features in great detail. So instead of talking about things that we've already been talking about, today we're going to talk about some new things related to high availability and site resilience. Specifically, we're going to be talking about the underlying architecture of the database availability group. We're going to go very deep and talk about all the components in Exchange and Windows failover clustering that are used to create a database availability group. We're also going to talk about what a witness server is and where you should place your witness server based on your business requirements and based on your availability needs. And this is not necessarily a new discussion for Exchange 2013, but it's a more complicated discussion in 2013 because of the architectural changes that we've made. We're also going to talk about a feature called Dynamic Quorum that is in all Windows Server 2012 clusters, including 2012 R2. And that is a feature that therefore affects database availability groups. And we'll talk about the implications of using that feature with your Exchange DAGs. And then we'll also talk about the new way in which you need to use maintenance mode for your DAG members. And this is different from what we did in previous versions of Exchange. And then after all that, I'm going to give you a sneak preview of a few things that are coming in our next release, Cumulative Update 3. Now, I don't have a date to give you as to when that will be released, but I do have a couple things that I can and will be talking about today. So let's start with the DAG architecture itself. How many of you have already deployed a database availability group, whether it's on Exchange 2010 or Exchange 2013? Have any of you actually deployed them? Okay, a few of you. So you may already have experience as to what's going on underneath the covers, but I still wanted to cover all of the components that we use because there's many of you who haven't yet deployed a DAG, and it's very important that you understand exactly what system components are involved and what those system components are doing. So let's start with the core, the primary service in Exchange underneath the database availability group. And that is called the Microsoft Exchange Replication Service. Think of that as the brain of high availability in Exchange 2013. Now, it exists in 2013, but it's not new for 2013. We actually introduced this service back in Exchange 2007 RTM when we introduced things like cluster continuous replication and standby continuous replication. And back then in Exchange 2007, we had a very different mechanism for our data redundancy, for our log shipping technology. Back then, we used server message block and hidden shares to transmit that log information. Beginning with Exchange 2010 and continuing in Exchange 2013, we now use TCP-based log shipping. We have a raw socket that is maintained between the server that hosts the active database copy and each server that hosts a passive copy of that database. There is an independent TCP socket that is maintained, and that is the mechanism through which we ship our data. The passive copy tells the active copy the last log file it received, and the active copy sends it any new data that's been generated since then. Now, that is one of the basic functionalities of the replication service. It's covered in this replay core manager component that we have. But as you can see, there's many, many other components that make up this service. So this one service is doing much more work than just log shipping and replay. For instance, this service has a copy status lookup component. And that component is there to look at the health and status of all of your database copies and your content index across an entire DAG and report and store that information in the cluster registry so that it can be shared across all of the DAG members. There's also an Active Directory lookup component, and that is there for two reasons. One, it's to determine membership within a DAG, but it's also there to answer Active Manager client communications that come from the client access server. And those communications are basically the client access server asking the mailbox server where a user's mailbox is located so that it can proxy communications to it. Some of the other components that we have, one is called the Seeding Manager. This is responsible for performing database seeding operations. When you make a copy of a database, that's called a seeding operation. A baseline copy of that database is copied to another server and then maintained through continuous replication. We also have the Auto Reseed Manager and the Disk Reclaimer Manager. These two components work together as part of that Auto Reseed feature I mentioned earlier. And once again, Auto Reseed is a feature that replaces a failed disk automatically and reseeds that failed disk with whatever database copies were lost as a result of the disk failing. So basically, it replaces the need to send an administrator out to do that work. And in fact, we created it in Office 365 specifically for that reason. As you might imagine, with an Exchange organization as large as Office 365, we see disks failing all the time. And if we had to send a person out there to replace a disk and then reseed the disk with the missing data, that would cost a lot of money. So instead, we came up with this auto reseed feature, which does that, and we put it into Exchange 2013 so that those of you who deploy on-premises can benefit from it as well. So the Disk Reclaimer Manager component is there to work with spare disks. About all the administrator needs to do to set up auto reseed is provision spare disks. And then, when a disk fails that contains active databases, the Disk Reclaimer Manager grabs that spare disk, and then the Auto Reseed Manager reseeds that disk with the missing data, thereby automatically establishing redundancy for those databases. Now, some of the other components that are in there, the VSS writer. If you are still taking VSS aware Exchange backups, that component will interface with your backup application. Now, we include the ability to backup inside Windows Server Backup. When you install an Exchange mailbox role, we include a plugin for Windows Server Backup that is a VSS plugin that allows you to take backups of your active and passive databases. In addition, the primary component inside the replication service is called Active Manager. Active Manager is there to do everything related to a DAG. Mount databases, respond to administrator interface queries, track database status health, choose what copy to activate in the event of a failure, and so forth. Active Manager does everything. In fact, even though the information store still mounts databases, in Exchange 2013, it will only do so if Active Manager asks it to do so. So Active Manager is a very important function. Some of these other functions here, the Failure Item Manager, that's there to track failure items that are written to a special area of the event viewer called the Crimson Channel. We'll talk about the Crimson Channel later. There's also a third-party replication API manager. In Exchange 2010, we introduced the ability to use third-party replication instead of the built-in continuous replication. And we created an API to do that, and that API is also serviced through this replication service. So as you can see, the replication service is very heavy duty. It has a lot of responsibilities and a lot of work that make it an important, critical, and required service on all of your mailbox servers. But it doesn't do its work alone. In fact, recently in CU2, we took some of the functionality out of the replication service and we put it into a new service that we created called the Microsoft Exchange DAG Management Service, or MS Exchange DAG MGMT for short. And this is a service that we created specifically to offload functionality from the replication service. Now, this service typically only has four components in it, but actually out of these four, only the monitoring component is actually working. The other three components are disabled in code. So we've moved the functionality over, but we haven't completely turned it on. Only the monitoring function exists in this new DAG management service. And again, the DAG management service was simply created for two primary reasons. One was so that we could take some of the work that the replication service was doing and move it to another process. And two, so that we could refactor how the replication service operated so that when managed availability needed to take corrective action, it didn't affect important functions. In other words, we take the non-essential functions out of the replication service, put them into the DAG management service, and now the DAG management service is doing things that are necessary but not critical or required for normal operations. Those kinds of things will remain in the replication service. Now, literally what we did was we copied and pasted the code and gave it a new service name. So what that means is the work that the DAG management service is doing actually pretends as if it were the replication service. When it logs an event to the event log, it'll use the same source as the replication service, MS Exchange REPL. It will write to the same areas of the event log as the replication service as well. Now, in the future, as we refactor the replication service more, we'll start to move more and more functionality out of the replication service and into this DAG management service. Things that we have planned are things like the auto reseed and disk reclaimer functionality. We also have functionality called dynamic replay lag playdown. And that is the ability for the system to automatically take a lagged database copy and start bringing it forward in time in response to some sort of critical situation, something like you're running low on disk space. Okay? If you're starting to run low on disk space, you want the database to stay mounted and stay up to date. So with dynamic replay lag playdown, we have the ability for the system to do that. Now, that's another function that will eventually move into the DAG management service. And then in the future, we have more plans to add additional DAG functionality. In fact, at the end, I'll talk about some new properties that are coming for the DAG in CU3. But you can already use a commandlet like get database availability group and view the properties of a database availability group, and you'll see all of these properties that start with the term autodag, this term autodag. You can look at those property names. They won't have any values, but you can look at those property names, and those properties will give you an idea as to future functionality that will become later with future updates. Now, those are the Exchange services. In addition to those two Exchange services, every database availability group also sits on top of a Windows failover cluster. So that means the Windows failover cluster service is used and required for every database availability group member. Now, obviously, the cluster service is not new. It's been around for quite some time. It was introduced way back in NT Enterprise Edition in 1997. So it's been around for a fairly long time, and it's very mature and robust and stable code. Now, Exchange is not a cluster-aware application. Rather, Exchange is a consumer of clustering technology. So by that, I mean we use cluster components like Quorum. We use the cluster's membership and node management APIs to group servers together. We use the cluster networking and heartbeating technology. And we use the cluster registry, sometimes called the cluster database, for storing information that can change very quickly. So let me talk about some of those things. First, let's talk about the most important cluster component, this concept of Quorum. Quorum is required in order to mount databases. If your cluster does not have Quorum, you do not have an operational DAG. Quorum is based on votes, not membership. And this is different from how we've done it in the past. Quorum is a voting-based mechanism that requires a majority of votes to be up and available and communicating with one another in order for Quorum to be established and maintained. If a majority of voters cannot communicate with one another, Quorum is lost and the solution terminates. Now, voting can be rigged. Votes can be taken away manually by an administrator for a variety of reasons, or they can be taken away dynamically by a new feature in Windows Server 2012 called Dynamic Quorum. Again, we'll talk about Dynamic Quorum in a bit. Now, it's important to remember that Exchange manages the Quorum model, not Quorum itself. And Exchange's management of the Quorum model is based simply on the number of members in your DAG. If you have an even number of members in your DAG, then Exchange will tell the cluster to use a node and file share majority Quorum. If you have an odd number of members in your DAG, then Exchange will tell the cluster to use a node majority Quorum. Those are the only two Quorum models that we used, and those are the only instructions Exchange has. And because Exchange's instructions to the cluster are based on the number of DAG members and not on the number of votes, what that means is if you do manually take votes away from your DAG members, you will have to manage the cluster Quorum model manually. Exchange won't be able to do it because it doesn't know anything about votes. Exchange only knows about members. It doesn't know whether or not those members have a vote. Now, we use the cluster registry to store information. Active Manager, in particular, stores database mount and database status and administrator action information inside the cluster registry, inside this cluster database that you can see here on the screen. And I'll zoom in for you in a minute so you can see that more clearly. Now, we store this information inside the cluster registry because that information is immediately replicated to all other DAG members. We couldn't store the information in Active Directory, for example, because we would be inhibited by Active Directory replication latency. It might take 15 minutes or maybe an hour for that information to get around Active Directory. We can't wait that long in an environment where we may have databases switching over or failing over in 30 seconds or less. So we write that information inside the cluster registry, and anytime we write information in there, it's instantly copied to all the other DAG members by the cluster. That is a cluster function that we use there. Now, here's an example of what that registry entry looks like. So you can see that we have information like, what is the active server? What server hosts the active copy of this database? In this case, it's server EX2. It was last mounted on server EX2. And you can see the last mounted time, and the mount status is also currently set to mounted. Then there's two other pieces of information that we have in there. One is admin dismounted? And the other is automatic actions allowed. Those pieces of information are there to record the administrator's intent. So for instance, if an administrator has dismounted a database, then this value will be true. And that is telling Active Manager that this database was dismounted by an administrator, so do not automatically mount it. Now, the other piece of information is called, is automatic actions allowed? And this tells Active Manager whether or not the database is blocked from activation and mounting, again, by an administrator. If that is set to true, then Active Manager will not automatically mount that database when needed. In both those cases, it would be up to the administrator to manually mount those databases. Okay, so Active Manager not only records its own information, but it also records information about actions the administrator has taken so that it knows whether or not the administrator wants this database mounted. Some of the other information we store in the cluster registry are things like the last log. I mentioned that our log shipping is now a communication process whereby the passive copy tells the active copy the last log it received, and then the active copy sends it any new logs that have been generated since then. And we store that information here inside the cluster registry, inside the cluster database, which is actually an area in the Windows registry itself. And we store it based on the database GUID. So this long number that you see here does match the actual GUID that's assigned to the mailbox database. And you can use Get Mailbox Database to see what that GUID is. And then the other piece of information we store is the last log number in decimal and the date and timestamp that last log was sent. And again, we store that information to keep track of what data has already been sent to the passive copy so that we only send it new data that has been generated since then. And obviously, we're storing it here so that it's persisted in case the system is rebooted or it has a hardware failure. We don't store this just in memory. We persist it in the registry so when the system comes back up, it can start right from where it left off. Now, we also use the cluster networks, and we specifically use them for their heartbeating technology. Now, how many of you have heard of the concept of a heartbeat network in a cluster? Okay, only like one or two hands went up. And that's okay, because technically there is no such thing. The reason for that is that all network interfaces are heartbeated by the cluster. This just goes on automatically. The cluster handles all unique subnets. Each unique subnet becomes a unique interface, and each unique interface is heartbeated across all other interfaces. Now, heartbeat tolerances, in other words, the system's ability to tolerate lost or missing heartbeats, are now configurable. So you have the ability both on an intra and inter subnet capability to configure heartbeat tolerances. This would be useful if you had lower bandwidth or highly latent networks. Now, we still do have the requirement of all DAG members requiring no greater than 500 millisecond round-trip return latency between them. So if you already have that high of latency, that's pretty high latency. You would not want to adjust these settings because you're really just masking the problem when you do that. In those cases, you would actually want to improve your network bandwidth or reduce your network latency. You would not want to manipulate these settings. But let's say you had maybe 250 milliseconds of round-trip return latency. That's within the support boundary. That's not the best experience, but it is supportable and it is workable. In those cases, if you are seeing issues with cluster members losing connectivity, then you might want to adjust some of these settings accordingly. Now, the cluster networking communications, in terms of everything that's not a heartbeat, so things like cluster updates, things like node management updates or global updates or any intra-cluster communications, cluster registry writes that don't involve heartbeats, those happen on UDP port 3343, and those are unicast packets. Heartbeats are always going to be TCP packets. So those will always be TCP from one interface to all other interfaces on all other DAG members. Now, even though the cluster networking sets everything up the way we need it to, and when you install Exchange, each individual cluster network becomes an Exchange network, it's still important to configure Windows network binding order as well. So what that means is that your MAPI network will always be at the top of the binding order, followed by your replication networks, one or more if you have them, and then followed by any iSCSI networks that you might have for iSCSI-based storage. Now, there's also the Crimson Channel, and this is actually a component of Windows Server, not Windows Clustering. And this is simply an area inside the Event Viewer that is there so that applications can log information that is not generally for administrator consumption. And in fact, there are multiple channels that are used by Exchange 2013. So you can see what those look like right here. So if you pull up Event Viewer and you look under Applications and Services Logs, let me zoom in on this for you. If you look under this Applications and Services Logs and under Microsoft and under Exchange, you will see this set of folders here, this set of event logs. This is the Crimson Channel that is automatically created when you install Exchange onto Windows Server. And this is the special area where Exchange logs critical information about what the system is doing. For instance, as you can see, there's one called Managed Availability. This is where we log everything about Managed Availability, all the information about the probes, all the information about the responders and the monitors, and any recovery actions that Managed Availability automatically takes. We log into this special area. This is also where we log area related to mailbox database failures and high availability in general. In fact, several components within Exchange use this Crimson Channel to communicate with one another. If the extensible storage engine, that's the database engine we use in Exchange, if that can't write to or read from a database, it logs an event in the Crimson Channel. An active manager sees that event, and in response to it, it takes corrective action to resolve the problem. Typically, that resolution would be a database failover. But you can see how the Crimson Channel is necessary and important for internal Exchange operations. And in fact, it is so important for internal operations that if Exchange has any problem writing to or reading from any of those event logs, it will self-correct the problem by terminating that server, by bug checking the server, causing an intentional blue screen, thereby rebooting it and failing over all active copies to another healthy server. So it's a very critical and important piece of Windows technology that is also used for your database availability groups. All right, now let's talk about the witness server and witness server placement, where you would put the server to act as a witness. So in case you're not familiar with it, a witness server is there for all DAGs that have an even number of members. So all DAGs that are using the node and file share majority quorum model use a witness server. Now, the witness server itself is actually a required property that you'll need to configure for all DAGs, but it will only be used when your DAG has an even number of members. So when you add the second member, the fourth member, the sixth member, the eighth or 10th, 12th, 14th, or 16th. 16 is the largest you can grow a DAG. So in all those cases, a witness server will be used. Now, earlier I mentioned that Exchange is not a cluster-aware application. And by that, I meant that if you look inside the failover cluster management tool, you won't see any Exchange resources. All you will see there are the cluster core, or what we call the default cluster resources. That would be the network name resource for the name of the cluster, which is also the name of the DAG. And there would be an IP address resource representing an IP address on each subnet for your MAPI network. Now, whenever your DAG is using the node and file share majority, there will be one extra resource there, and that is called the file share witness resource. And this resource is how the cluster manages the witness server. So the witness server is simply a server that is outside the DAG, outside the cluster, that is there to provide an extra vote in the event that there's a tie. Again, it's only used for even number DAGs. So if you've got eight members, you have the ability of having four think one thing and four think something else. You need a tiebreaker in there, and that's basically what the witness is used for. Now, if the witness server or the witness share becomes unavailable, then it goes into a failed state, and the cluster will automatically move those core resources over to another server trying to restart that resource. And if the resource can be restarted, it'll be brought back online. If it can't be restarted, maybe because the witness server is still down, then it will remain in a failed state, and the cluster will try to bring it on once an hour. Now, if the witness is needed for quorum and this resource cannot be brought online, then quorum will be lost and the solution will terminate. So it's important that whatever server you use for your witness server, it be under the Exchange administrator's radar. Now, the way the witness server is used is there's two text files that are stored in the file share that's created. One text file is used by the cluster using its isAlive functionality to make sure that the share is still there. The other text file is called witness.log, and it's there that information about quorum is maintained. And it's basically a sequence number in the form of a date and timestamp that is incremented when the witness server is needed for quorum. Now, when the witness server is needed to maintain quorum, one of the DAG members will reach out and lock that witness.log file. Okay? All the other DAG members have to wait 6 seconds, and then they'll try to lock it, but one DAG member gets a head start. And so when it's no longer needed for quorum, then the lock on that witness is released. Now, the node that locks the witness.log file is called, surprisingly, the locking node. All other DAG members that are in communication with the locking node, if there are a majority of them, they will maintain quorum and they will continue running and databases will stay mounted. The minority or nodes that cannot communicate with the locking node will be in the minority. They will lose quorum and their databases will dismount and they will no longer participate in DAG operations. Now, the node that owns the default cluster core group always gets to try to lock the witness first. It gets a 6-second head start over all of the other nodes. Now, that happens to be the same node that we use in Exchange for the primary active manager role in a database availability group. So whatever server has the PAM role, that server will get the first crack at locking the witness log. So it looks something like this. Here's a very basic cluster. We've got two nodes in our cluster, and over here is our witness file. So inside the witness.log file is that Paxos tag information I mentioned. Again, that's just a sequencing number. So we'll just say that the sequencing number understood by both nodes is 20 right now. And the node at the top owns the cluster core resources. This node is just a passive node down here. So if we lose the network between those nodes, both nodes still can communicate with the witness server, but only one node gets to try to lock it first. And that's going to be the top node because it owns the cluster core resources. So it tries right away to lock the node. We'll say 1 second after the failure happens. 6 seconds after that, which would be 7 seconds after the failure happens, the other node tries to reach out and lock the witness file. But it reads the witness file and it says that, oh, the sequence number is 21 and my sequence number is only 20, which means somebody else has already locked that file and they've already incremented the sequence number from 20 to 21. Therefore, I can't be a locking node, the challenge fails, and I need to try to communicate with this node, which I can't. So this one will terminate now. The locking node is successful and it maintains quorum and stays up and running. And then, of course, once the nodes can communicate, they will update to the same sequence number, and then the lock on that witness.log file will be immediately released. Okay? That is literally the only way in which the witness server gets used. So here's another example. Now let's say instead of losing the network between them, we actually lose the node that owns the cluster core resources. Now the behavior is still the same, except what's going to happen there is that the cluster core resources now have to change ownership. So this node down here now needs to take ownership of them, which it does. And as soon as it does, then it can also reach out and lock that witness.log file and increment the sequence from 20 to 21. Thereby maintaining quorum. So even if the node that owns the cluster core resources fails, the other node still has the opportunity to lock the witness and still maintain quorum and keep up and running. And then, of course, when you bring that other server back up, the lock is released and the sequence number is incremented for all of them. Now, in terms of where to place this witness server, in Exchange 2010, we had pretty simple guidance. And that guidance was to find a hub transport server inside the same Active Directory site as your DAG that didn't have the mailbox role on it and use that server as your witness server. And again, the only reason we recommended using an Exchange server was so that the Exchange administrator could keep tabs on the witness server, because you don't want to obviously reboot your witness server if it's currently locked and needed to maintain quorum. Now, Exchange 2013 complicates things a bit, in part because we made architectural changes that give you new options, specifically options like a third data center or a branch office that simply weren't available or possible in previous versions of Exchange. So now, what we're saying is ultimately the placement of the witness server is going to depend on your business goals and your availability needs. Now, obviously, if you have a single DAG within a single AD site, then you're going to place the witness server in that site. We don't need any special guidance there. If you have a single DAG or multiple DAGs extended across multiple data centers, then we would recommend that you place your witness server in what we would call your primary site, the site that you want to have the majority of votes. If you've got multiple DAGs extended across multiple data centers and you have a third location available to you, then we could recommend using that third location, in which case you would get automatic site resilience for your DAG in response to a site-level failure. And then, of course, if you've got single or multiple DAGs extended to more than two data centers, then we would again recommend that you pick one of those data centers as your primary data center and put the witness server in that location. Now, as I mentioned, a DAG's witness server can be placed in a third location, thereby providing you with automatic site resilience. Generally, our only requirement for doing that is that this third location, whether it's a full-blown data center or a branch office or just some third location that you have, that it have its networking isolated from any failures that affect the other two sites where your Exchange servers are deployed. So two of your sites have Exchange, the third site has a witness server, which does not need to be an Exchange server, and as long as you have network isolation, then a third site becomes a reality for you and gives you the ability to have automatic site resilience. If you don't have that isolation, if, for example, you have a hub and spoke network configuration, even with a third location, you would not be able to do that. You have to have network isolation. And then, of course, for all database availability groups, as I mentioned, the availability of the witness server needs to be under the Exchange admin's radar. The Exchange admin needs to know what the state of quorum is, if the witness server is being used, and whether or not it's safe to turn off and on the witness server in a maintenance period. Now, Windows Azure and similar infrastructure as a service deployments are not supported for a third location. So unfortunately, those deployments do not yet have the underlying networking infrastructure that is required to support a site resilience configuration. You can go to this blog post that I wrote, and we'll explain why that is. But for now, IaaS providers, including Azure, are not supported for this third location for witness. So if you did want the third location option, you have to supply the third location yourself. Now let's talk about dynamic quorum. As I mentioned, dynamic quorum is a feature of Windows Server 2012 and later. It is enabled by default. It's turned on out of the box. And it's basically a change in the way that cluster determines the number of votes that are needed to maintain quorum. In Windows Server 2012 and later, the cluster now dynamically changes the number of votes required for quorum based on whether nodes are up or down. And this is different. In the past, it was based on whether or not nodes were a part of the configuration or not. In other words, it was based on membership previously. Now it's based on state, whether or not the node is up or down. So in other words, when a node shuts down, its vote is dynamically taken away. When a node comes back up and successfully rejoins the cluster, its vote is dynamically given back to it. And this all happens by the cluster service. There's nothing that the administrator needs to do. Now, that means that the cluster will dynamically change the number of votes needed for a majority as long as it can regain quorum after some form of failure. Typically, we're talking about sequential failures. So what that means, it's now possible for a Windows Server 2012 cluster, or it's now possible for a database availability group, to keep running down to its last surviving node. If the cluster continues to have quorum, then it will continue dynamically reducing the number of votes that are needed to maintain quorum until it gets down to just one vote needed by that one surviving node, and this is called a last man standing scenario. Now, I'll talk about that with some animation, why the last man standing scenario is interesting, but not really going to do anything for you from a DAG perspective. So dynamic quorum, though, it's important to understand that it doesn't allow the loss of a majority and then the system keeps going. Anytime dynamic quorum works, after a failure, you always have to reestablish quorum. So failure happens, quorum must be established, then dynamic quorum shrinks the number that's needed. Okay? The number will not get shrunken unless quorum can be achieved. Now, the other thing to consider is, I mentioned earlier, votes can also be manually taken away. You can manipulate the node weight property of a DAG member or of a cluster member. And in doing so, if you take that vote away, dynamic quorum cannot dynamically give that vote back. If an administrator manually takes a vote away, that vote is gone permanently until the admin gives it back. So, let me give you an example of how dynamic quorum works. We have two data centers here. This is my primary data center. I have three DAG members and a witness server. And this is my backup data center that also has three DAG members in it. Now, let's assume that right now, dynamic quorum has a value of 7 votes that maintain quorum. So we always need a majority of 7 to maintain quorum. In other words, we need at least 4 out of 7 members to be up and communicating with each other to maintain quorum. Where does 7 come from? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and that extra vote given to even number DAGs by that witness server means 7 votes. Now, what happens if we lose the WAN? Okay, what's going to happen to the servers on this side? Are they going to stay up or are they going to go down? Just shout it out if you think you know the answer. Up or down? I heard an up. Anybody else got an answer? No? Okay, well, they're actually going to go down. The reason that these three go down is because they're in the minority. Remember, the majority is at least 4 votes out of 7. Well, here we only have 3 votes, and they cannot communicate with any of these nodes, one of which who's locked the witness server, so they're in the minority and they go down. However, we still have 4 votes, 1, 2, 3, and this 4th one right here. So because we have 4 votes, this side maintains quorum. And after it maintains quorum, that's the point at which dynamic quorum changes the number from 7 to 4. So now, even though we originally had 7 votes, we now are acting as if we only have 4, which means we need a majority of 4 to stay up, which would be 2 or more votes. So I can lose another server, and now we can still maintain quorum because we still have 3 votes. And because we can maintain quorum, dynamic quorum reduces the count from 4 to 3. Now, what's interesting is 2 is also a majority of 3. So I can lose one more thing and still have the solution up and running. So let's say I lose this server right here. So now the witness server is needed to maintain quorum, and this server will have a lock on it. Now, dynamic quorum, because we're able to maintain quorum, will once again reduce that count down to 2. Okay, so now here we are with this last man standing, the only DAG member that we have up and running. We'll come back to that scenario in a moment. But let's just say, for example, instead of losing one of these members, we actually lost the witness server. The same thing would happen as if we lost one of the members here. If we lose the witness server instead, we still have 2, which is a majority of 3, so we still maintain quorum, and dynamic quorum still keeps the vote count at 2. Now, here's where things get interesting. When I'm down to just 2 servers in the cluster, if both of them are cluster members, dynamic quorum will take the away from one of them. And you have no control. So 0 means no vote, 1 means a vote. It's the cluster that's going to randomly choose one of these surviving servers and take its vote away. What that means is this server could get shut down, and this doesn't have a vote, so it will terminate. However, this server could get shut down. It didn't have a vote, so we're not losing anything, and this one can stay up as the last man standing. But again, we have no control over which server is going to get the vote. It might be the other way around, or it might be that way, or it might be that way. We don't know. The cluster is going to randomly decide. Okay? So what that means is you actually need to figure out which one has the vote before you can take any other action, like shutting down another DAG member. So let's talk about this last man standing. Let's say you do shut the one down that doesn't have the vote. This one has the vote. It's now the last man standing. One of the challenges with this is it's the last man standing, which means all of the active databases are now going to try to mount on that one single surviving server. All the databases that were previously mounted here, 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 and here. So the entire load of a 6-member DAG is now going to be placed on this one server. There is a low degree of likelihood that that server will be able to handle that load. The chances of you building out that server so that it can handle the load and be a last man standing are very slim to none. So it's not a configuration we would want you to plan for as part of your resiliency and redundancy plans when you're designing your DAGs. So while it is possible for this scenario to happen, our guidance is actually to pretend as if it doesn't even exist, because you're not ever going to design for this scenario. You're not going to over-design each of your servers so that they could potentially be the last man standing and carry the entire load. You would never over-provision your servers that way. So again, even though the cluster may be able to continue running, it's not very likely that you'll have a sufficient amount of resources on one server to handle the full database and client access load from all the other servers. Now, how do you figure out who has the vote and who doesn't? Well, you use the get cluster node commandlet. And you can see this example that I have here. So we've got the server name, and we've got two weights. One is called dynamic weight. The other is called node weight. Node weight is where the administrator can manually take that vote away. So if the administrator sets node weight to 0, then the server has no vote at all. Dynamic weight is what the cluster does through dynamic quorum. If it has a 1 under dynamic weight, it still has a vote. If it has a 0 under dynamic weight, then the cluster took that vote away, and that server can go up or down, and it won't affect quorum at all. You can also use the validate cluster quorum test in the failover cluster management tools to check vote assignment as well. Typically, we don't recommend manually taking votes away from DAG members, but there are certain configurations, particularly with asymmetric DAGs, DAGs in which you have an odd number of members, and maybe you've deployed 5 members to one location and 4 members to another location, where you might want to take votes away and have either non-voting DAG members or voting only DAG members, depending on your resiliency needs. Now, dynamic quorum does work with DAGs. Exchange, however, is not dynamic quorum aware. It has no idea that dynamic quorum is taking away votes or giving votes back. And it doesn't change the requirements for quorum. Quorum is still needed in order for a DAG to mount databases and to service clients. Now, you should know that all the testing that we do, everything from our build labs to our test labs to our dog food environments to our production environments to all of Office 365 servers that are running on Windows Server 2012, dynamic quorum is enabled, and we do operate it in all of our test cases. So the cluster team guidance is to basically leave it on, because it's allowing you to survive failure cases where previously with Windows Server 2008 R2, you would not be able to survive them. You would have had loss of quorum and the solution would have terminated. Now, the Exchange team guidance is leave it on from the majority of DAGs. Again, the one case where you might want to turn it off is where you have your DAG extended across multiple data centers and you have perhaps better administrative access to one data center than another data center. And in that case, you may not have the ability to tell if dynamic quorum has given or taken away votes. And so you might need to, in those examples, turn dynamic quorum off. But for the majority of DAGs and the majority of customers, keep dynamic quorum enabled, but don't factor it in to your resiliency or redundancy plans. Yes, it may allow the DAG to keep operating in conditions that it would have terminated in previous versions of Exchange and Windows, but don't plan for those types of outages and just operate as if it weren't even there. All right. The last thing that we're going to talk about is DAG member maintenance. And again, one of the reasons that we wanted to talk about that is because it has changed significantly in Exchange 2013. In Exchange 2010, we made doing maintenance on a DAG member super easy. In fact, we included a script, a set of scripts. One was called Start DAG Server Maintenance. You would run that script, and it would do a bunch of things to that DAG member to prepare it for going into maintenance mode. It would pause it from a cluster perspective. It would move all the active databases over to another server. It would block databases from becoming active. And it would do all other things to quiesce that server from a DAG perspective. Then you would do whatever maintenance you needed to, install an update rollup or a service pack or some sort of Windows update or some sort of hardware update. And then you would run stop DAG server maintenance, and it would basically undo the maintenance mode and put the server back into production. Now, that was really easy to do. Again, we included the scripts, and it didn't take that much time to run them at all. Exchange 2013, the guidance is a bit more complicated, and it's a bit more complicated for two primary reasons. One reason is because of managed availability. Again, managed availability is high availability that extends to all other components. So what that means is if I stop a critical service or if I disable a critical component, managed availability will come in and start that service or enable that component and do whatever it takes to reestablish user access to that system. So that makes things complicated. As part of maintenance mode, I need to turn off managed availability so it doesn't do those kinds of things to me. And secondly, we've changed the architecture of Exchange 2013. Specifically, the mailbox role now has all the other roles inside of it. It has the legacy client access role, it has the legacy hub transport role, the unified messaging role, and of course the mailbox role. So it's not just enough to stop the cluster or move databases. I have to stop transport, I have to stop unified messaging, I have to drain the queues, and as I mentioned, I have to turn off managed availability. Now, we don't include a script that will tell you how to do that, but I've got everything that you need to know written in the slide right here. So let me walk you through what we're basically doing here. These first two commands that we're doing, the set server component state command, the first one that we're doing is affecting a component called hub transport. And we're putting that component into a state of draining, and we're using a requester tag called maintenance. And this is the way of saying that an administrator is draining the transport queue because they are about to do some sort of maintenance on this server. So what this does is this turns off the component for managed availability so that managed availability is no longer monitoring and taking recovery actions. The next thing I do is I set the server component state for a component called UM call router, and that is the UM call component that may be servicing active calls. I also set that to a state of draining as well, and I do that to tell managed availability that I'm draining the UM queue as well. Then, in order for managed availability's hub transport state change to take effect, you actually have to restart the transport service. So that's what that restart service MS Exchange transport does. The next line is redirect message, and what this does is it takes messages that are in the transport queue and redirects them to the fully qualified domain name of some other transport server. It basically drains the queue much faster for you. Then the next thing that we do is suspend the cluster node, and that will go ahead and pause that cluster node prevent it from doing things like inheriting the cluster core components or inheriting the PAM role in the case of the DAG. Then a couple other things we do. We do set mailbox server a couple times. One, so that we can move all the active databases off the server. And the second time, so that we can block the server from activation. And then the last thing that we do is we take this set server component state. And in this case, the component that we're manipulating is called server-wide offline. And this is the component that maps to the managed availability responders. And so this shuts off all of the corrective action that managed availability can do on this server. Now, once I have placed the server in maintenance mode, I do like to go ahead and verify that the server is actually in maintenance mode. So I'll run get server component state, and then I'll set all the components, and you should see them in an inactive state. The next thing I'll do is I'll run get mailbox server, and I'll look at the database copy properties, and you should see that these are all passive databases on the server, and that the data that the server is blocked for activation. Then I'll run get cluster node to make sure that it's paused, and then I'll run get queue to make sure that the actual transport queues are completely empty. At that point, I can go ahead and do my maintenance, and managed availability won't affect me. There won't be any client activity. There won't be any active databases on there. I can do whatever I need to that server, install updates, reboot it, etc. Then, once I'm done, I can take it out of maintenance mode and put it into production mode. And as you can see, a lot of this is basically undoing everything that we did in the previous set of steps. We'll set the server component state for the server-wide offline. We'll change that so that it is now in a state of active. We'll also do the same thing for the UM call router so that UM can once again accept calls. We'll go ahead and disable the movement of databases. And we'll unblock activation for those databases. Then we'll also re-engage hub transport, and then we'll restart the transport service so that transport can take that change can take effect. And then once again at the end, I like to just run a few steps to verify that the server is back in an active state, that database copies are active, that the cluster node is not paused, and that queues are starting to be created and servicing messages again. All right, now these are actually the exact same steps we do in Office 365 to take a server and put it into maintenance mode or take it out of maintenance mode. Even though we did not include a script, you can certainly take these commands and turn them into a PowerShell script yourself. You can literally copy and paste them and then use things like computer name environment variables or hard code computer names in there if you prefer to do it that way. All right, now the very last thing I want to talk about are things that haven't been released yet. They're just a few minor changes that are coming in cumulative update 3. As I mentioned previously, I do not have any date to give you as to when CU3 will be released, but I am going to talk about a few things because these are the kinds of things that I need to write about in the TechNet documentation when we do ship CU3. So, again, just a few minor things. One of the things we're adding is we're adding a parameter called skip maximum active database checks for the move active mailbox database commandlet. That is the commandlet that you use to trigger what we call a database switchover. Or you can also use that commandlet to trigger a server switchover, move all active databases to one or more other servers in the DAG. This skip maximum active database checks parameter, as its name implies, is there to skip checking whether or not a cap has been placed on the maximum number of databases that can be mounted by this server. There is a property that you can set with set mailbox server called max active active databases, and that is the maximum number that Active Manager will allow to be mounted if it has been configured by an administrator. If you need to override that setting and forcibly mount a database, you'll be able to do that with that parameter in CU3. We will also have a couple new AutoDAG properties available for you to configure as well. One is called AutoDAG Auto Reseed Enabled. That will determine whether or not auto reseed is turned on or off. And the other is AutoDAG Disk Reclaimer Enabled. That will determine whether or not the spare disk reclaimer functionality will be enabled or not. Right now, the way we have it configured in CU2 and earlier is if you configure some AutoDAG properties, such as your database location, your storage location, and the number of copies per volume that you have, then auto reseed is automatically enabled, as is the disk reclaimer. Now we give you, through SetDAG, the ability to turn those things off if you're not using that functionality. The last thing that we've done, and this, you might actually consider these two things. So update database schema is a new commandlet that we added in Exchange 2013 CU1 so that customers had the ability to manually update the database schema at their convenience. So historically, the database schema has typically been updated automatically by the system whenever the database is mounted on a later version of the code. So if you took an RTM database and mounted it on a CU1 server, the database schema would get automatically upgraded in the past. Now we have a commandlet that you can use called update database schema. And in CU3, we're adding a database group parameter so that you can update the database schema for all databases inside a particular DAG. So we make it easy for you to just do an entire DAG with one fell swoop. And that way, it's a much smoother and easier process for you. All right. So with that, I know we've got about 5 or 10 minutes left, and I'm very happy to answer any questions that you might have. And I do have a few lovely gifts for people who ask particularly good questions. So like a good question would be about the DAG or high availability. A good question would not be, can I have a gift? So as an example. So who would like to go first? So I take it then everything was 100% clear, and now you understand everything about DAGs, and so you don't have any questions. Yes, sir. So you're curious as to how to configure automatic failover. So there is nothing that you need to do other than creating a DAG, adding your mailbox servers to a DAG, and then creating copies of your mailbox databases across the servers in the DAG. The DAG already has the functionality inside of it so that if there's a problem with a disk or the network or a server or some other crash or something like that, automatic failover happens automatically. There's nothing that you need to do to configure it. What you might want to do is maybe control it. So as an example, maybe you've got some servers that are going to be disaster recovery servers and not high availability servers. You might want the system to keep those copies up to date, but not automatically fail over to them, and that's called blocking activation. But if you don't block activation, then failover will happen automatically across your DAG, and when any failure affects the active copy of a database, Active Manager will automatically take corrective action and take a passive copy and automatically activate it. And that process is called a database failover. And the internal process that Active Manager uses is called best copy and server selection. So best copy and server selection is a process where Active Manager looks at all the servers that have a passive copy of the database and picks the best one, the most healthiest, the best up-to-date, the one where everything is good, and chooses that one, and that's where things become automatically active. And that happens generally within 30 seconds or less. And in fact, usually it's much faster than that. In Exchange 2010, we would see failover times around 20 seconds. In Exchange 2013, we actually see failover times about 10 seconds. So, good question. Great question. So that qualifies you either for a sweatshirt or one of these cool phones that plugs into your other actual phone. So what would you like? A pink phone, perhaps? No? A green phone, perhaps? Or a medium or large sweatshirt? All right, green phone. Thank you for the question. All right, who's next? Yes, sir.
The primary data center at the local machine runs about 16 milliseconds
Sure. So the question is that you've got, did you say 16 milliseconds or 60 milliseconds? 16? 16 milliseconds. That's very low latency between data centers. So absolutely, your witness server could go anywhere. The requirement that we have around DAG members and latency applies only to your mailbox servers. It doesn't apply to the witness server. The witness server is really just a very lightly used file share. It is periodically heartbeated by the cluster, but that's just a very simple is alive check. We just open a text file and see if we can write to it. Otherwise, unless it's used for maintaining quorum, the witness server isn't used at all, and so there aren't really any network bandwidth or latency requirements. The only requirement we would have is that when you're in a third data center location, that the witness server's network be isolated from failures affecting the other two data centers. Otherwise, your bandwidth is just fine, and you won't have any problems from a network standpoint. So please come and help yourself. All right, who's next? I think we've got a couple more minutes. Those phones go first all the time. Yeah. Let me also go. Put my email address back up there, too. So if you can't think of any questions today and you want to email me after the show, I would love to answer those questions as well. Did I see another hand go up over here somewhere? Yes, sir. Great, so the question is, if we use Windows Server Backup to back up our databases, that will truncate the transaction logs. How will that affect continuous replication? It really won't. When you are backing up, as you saw on this slide right here, the VSS writer component, the component that's actually handling the backup from the exchange perspective, is built into the replication service. And the replication service, as part of a VSS backup, coordinates that activity with the information store. So whether you're backing up an active copy or the passive copy, that information is communicated through the log shipping mechanism. We'll actually write the backup into the active copy. That'll generate a log file, and that log file will replicate to the passive copies, and that's how the passive copies will know to update their database headers that the backup has completed as well. So any backups that you take are completely integrated into the replication pipeline and coordinated across the store and replication service on the active and the passive copies. One other thing to keep in mind is sometimes that also begs the question, if I'm not taking backups, how do transaction logs get truncated then? And the answer to that would be to use circular logging. And the idea is that you're not taking backups because you're using what we call exchange native data protection, which would be a combination of mailbox database copies in the DAG, plus single item recovery, and possibly a lag copy if you like the ability to go back in time for your database copies as well. All right, please help yourself to one of these sweatshirts. All right, we've got time for one more question, and conveniently we have one more sweatshirt to go with it, so who's going to be the brave soul? Now, you already had a question. I'm happy to answer another one, but I can't give you another gift, unless it's really super cool. Can it be used in DAG members that have an odd number of members? It can, but to do that, you would actually have to take that odd DAG member and put it in the third location. Basically, it'd be the question of spreading the votes across three locations in that case. That could, unless you have very good networking and very reliable networking, that probably would not be the better configuration, because unlike the witness server, which is just a file server that's very lightly used, having a DAG member in that third location means that you've got cluster communication, Active Directory communication, continuous replication going on, possibly client access and so forth, and that does make it a much more complicated type of solution. So generally what we recommend is if you are going to take any DAG and extend it across three data centers, that it still be an even number DAG and that you put the majority of votes in one data center that you would consider to be your primary data center. Thank you. All right, well, unless nobody has another question, I'm going to give this gentleman a sweatshirt. Well, all right. Thank you very much for coming. Please don't forget to fill out your evals, and I hope you enjoy the rest of Tech Days. Thank you. Bye-bye.